From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
With the right restrictions, tables 6 feet apart and away from the sidewalks, masks and distancing measures for staff, and other precautions, the experts believe that these services can open at a risk comparable to other outdoor activities.
I don't think the people that sent us here to represent them today intended for us to focus our time on a mask showdown of whether you're wearing it or you're not.
The Republicans have no excused absences today, and I would like to welcome back my seatmate, Representative Bailey.
That everyone who wants to vote has the opportunity to vote and does not have to choose between their vote and their safety, because none of us know what our landscape is going to look like in November.
But what we're proposing is a vote by drop box, which is not secure. It is just a recipe for voter fraud, and none of us wants to do that.
Lawmakers are giving approval to voting changes this fall, and also Governor J.B. Pritzker has agreed to let bars and restaurants open a bit more with some outdoor seating. That could be coming in the next week. And a face mask kerfuffle in the Illinois House. We'll discuss all of that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel today, still practicing social distancing from his home, we have Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us from the State House back there for the first time in weeks is the NPR Illinois reporter Sam Dunklaw, and glad to have with us Bill Wheelhouse, who is back reporting for NPR Illinois during the pandemic. Well, we're recording this show on Friday morning, and this special session of the Illinois legislature is still going. Lawmakers are still in Springfield. A lot more could pass before they're scheduled to leave town, but we'll talk about what we know at this point. And Sam, first, I want to kind of set the scene of what took place this week. Let's mention it was a different kind of session, to say the least. Senators met in their chamber with precautions taken, and the House session being held in a downtown Springfield convention center. How has that worked so far?
It seems to have worked pretty well so far. My observation of at least the House chamber, and of course Bill and a few of our other reporters have been there as well, is that if imagine a large convention floor with all these temporary tables with black cloths all set up at least 6 feet apart from one another. There are four sections that are all spread out. So far, in terms of technical issues, each legislator has a separate microphone there in the House, and there's a place for the chair to be able to stand in front of everybody. Video and audio-wise, things seem to have gone pretty well. It's been an adjustment for folks talking through their masks and other things like that, but the House, at least, has been able to conduct its business pretty well over there at the BOS Center. And the same thing has gone on in the Senate, who is meeting in their usual chambers here at the State House. But votes are taking a little bit longer because of the fact that they are being called in groups alphabetically to vote on individual bills. So, usually when five bills or so come across the screen, it's no problem because all senators are there usually in their seats and able to vote their switch. But this time it took a little bit longer. But nobody really seems to have any trouble waiting around for that whole process to go along because the majority, if not everyone, is concerned about conducting this session safely.
And Bill, there has been some limits on media as far and others who are coming in and out of those locations to watch and maybe even if you're staff to assist in what's taking place there. So it has been a little bit of a change, especially for reporters who are trying to cover this.
It does change things more. It's more isolating as it's supposed to be, but somebody said, how does it feel to return to the old stomping grounds? And I said, well, there's not a lot of stomping going on because you don't really get to go around and mingle.
So there have been a lot of things going on. And let me go back to Sam, because you've been one that's been in some of these locations, of course, following this. One of the big issues that we knew was going to come up was the question about how the election should be handled this fall, especially with the concerns over COVID-19. We might see the virus come back again in some big numbers. There were some questions of how do you keep people safe? It looks as though lawmakers have found a way to address that.
Yeah, and it's through a sort of, you know, election omnibus bill. Some changes that largely are focused on keeping voters as safe as possible as they attempt to cast their ballot. And the two sort of prongs of that, and of course, Bill Wheelhouse, who's on with us, did a feature on this week for us, who can speak a little bit more in detail about this. But the two prongs are essentially mailing everybody a vote-by-mail application. Now, initially, there was talk of sending all registered voters a vote-by-mail ballot. But there were some security and logistics questions with that. So it seems to be now the negotiations are whether or not we should send everybody a vote-by-mail application. They return it to their local election authority, and then the local election authority, of course, would be able to send them one back if they so choose. The other prong of this is trying to figure out how we can set up polling places so that they are socially distant and safe, at least as much as possible, from people being able to transmit or get the COVID-19 virus. There's been talk of making the election day this year a school holiday, so that way students and teachers can clear out of schools, and the ballot boxes can be sort of set up in a socially distant manner for voters to be able to come in to cast their ballot and not risk transmitting the virus to the more vulnerable population. There's also been talk of curbside voting as well. These are all things that are still being debated as we speak. The House had approved that bill last night. It's now over in the Senate for consideration.
And Bill, why don't you go ahead and fill us in as well on some of the unique ideas that could be coming up in this bill.
Yeah, and they're selling it as a COVID-related bill. And as one of the Republicans said, paraphrasing former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. The anticipation is that Democrats who are in fully control will later turn a lot of this into permanent legislation. And it's designed probably to help Democrats more so than Republicans. Sam alluded to the schools, and one of the things they've had happen, schools over the years have been declining in their participation of allowing voting to take place in their schools in fear of stranger danger with the kids and everything. And this would require schools to be open for voting if the local election authorities want it. So that is one point. But the real effort here is going to be this vote by mail. And you can do that already with absentee voting. Really, it's there now. But what this bill does is spell that out and require several mailings, about three mailings at least, to voters who voted in the elections of 18, 19, and the primary earlier this year, and would try to recruit them to vote by mail. Again, it wouldn't send the ballot, but would cost several million dollars to do. And then, of course, the cost would be incurred locally as well. They'd hope that some of that federal COVID assistance money would cover it, but in all likelihood, there would be some costs that local governments would have to eat. So that is the main focus. Then they throw in other things that are optional. You can create these voter drop boxes. So people who aren't satisfied with the U.S. mail can just go put it in this drop box that would reportedly be secure. And that is really one of the main things. It would also require more hours for in-person voting during the early voting period. They'd have to extend their hours at local election offices for things like that. And then, some minor adjustments here or there, such as making it easier for 16 and 17 year olds to serve as election judges. But Republicans say this thing is ripe for fraud. Democrats say it's, of course, just to get prevent illness. And there's agreement probably somewhere in the middle there. But the one thing to look at is those dates that go back to 2018 of the voters they have to send this to. It does leave out 2016, the year that maybe some people that don't ordinarily go to the polls had voted for Donald Trump, especially in some downstate areas. And those voters, if that's the only time they voted, won't be receiving any enticement to vote with the mail-in ballot.
Charlie, let me go back to something Bill had mentioned regarding the fact that right now we have absentee voting. A lot of different ways people can cast ballots. So, is this a big deal? Is it really that big of a change?
I would say, in my judgment, the only difference is that now, instead of someone who wants to vote by mail having to take the initiative to call the county clerk or the election authority to ask for the ballot, now you're going to get a notice saying, hey, if you want to apply, send this back and we'll send you one. I actually voted in March by mail for the first time since I started voting in the mid-60s. And it was really simple. There was not much to it. I went online and registered to get a ballot sent to me by the Sangamon County clerk. The ballot arrived. I filled it out, and rather than hand-deliver it down there, I had my daughter take it down to the county clerk's office for me. And on the ballot, there's a form where if you're going to have somebody else deliver it, you can sign saying, yes, this is the person who's going to deliver it, and then the person shows ID, and the county clerk accepts it. But had I not been as cheap as I am, and had I been able to figure out how much postage to put it on, I could have just put a stamp on it and dropped it in the mailbox. So it really is pretty easy. And as I say, the biggest difference is now the initiative won't rest with the voter. Instead, it will rest with the county clerk, the election authority, to notify the voter, hey, if you want to vote by mail, here's the application.
And as Bill mentioned earlier, this is now awaiting another vote, but it is likely that it is going to go through, and it sounds like Governor J.B. Pritzker would sign it once the legislature passes that. Let me move on to something else that right now we're, as we sat down again on a Friday morning to record this show, Sam, we are waiting to hear about the state budget. Where does that stand at this point?
The vehicle bills have come over from either chamber, and right now, as far as we know, there's talk of talking a little bit more in detail about what exactly is going to be included in the budget. And of course, Bill and Charlie, who have been following this a little bit closer, can speak in a little bit more detail. But we know that there is going to, of course, be a budget. In past years, that hasn't always, of course, been a guarantee. What is hinging largely on this budget is the amount of federal funding that the state may receive in order to prop itself up. Republicans have been crowing about this for the last couple of weeks. The state is facing something like a $7 billion deficit just in this year alone. And for the next fiscal year. And the governor has painted those same kind of grim revenue projections over the last month. This is where it all sort of comes down to. How is the state going to spend what resources it has? What is it going to expect from the federal government in order for us to get into the next fiscal year with some sense of stability?
And Bill, this is really the one thing that you could make an argument needed to get done when they were in town, or at least one of the very few items that has to get passed. So it does sound as though they're going to work towards something here. But, what do we know about what all is in it at this point? Do we have any idea?
Well, I think you can probably throw accurate math out the window. It's one giant rounding error, if you want to be generous. But I think a highlight in a lot of areas is related to COVID, and there'll be different parts of budget legislation and the implementation legislation that is designed, or another separate bill, all things to provide assistance for people, whether they're out of a job or shipping money that was to go to county fairs on over into the Ag Extension Fund and things like that, and giving the governor more flexibility to spend the money or see how that money is spent. And they're going to give him about three times the leeway, at least, that they have in the past.
And Charlie, let me go to you, because I know you've actually gone through this more than 2,000-page document. And what are some of the things you've noticed?
Yeah, and in a sense, the fact that the amendment that carries the budget is 2,258 pages long is misleading in the sense that only less than 700. The first 700 pages actually make modifications in the current budget and lay out a spending plan for the fiscal year that starts on July 1. And the remaining 1,600 or so pages are what are called reappropriations, money that was allocated for capital projects in past years that was not spent gets reallocated again. The authorization gets renewed every year until the money is spent. So there's something like 5,000 of those tucked in there. And most of them, skimming through them quickly, are things for individual members' initiatives back home, $25,000 to fix a playground or $40,000 for street lighting, that kind of stuff. A couple of things I found interesting. Usually the budget will contain, for the Department of Corrections, individual allocations for each prison broken down into things like personnel, commodities, telecommunications, all that kind of stuff. Well, this year, the individual allocations for prisons are listed at zero, and there is a lump sum for the Department of Corrections of roughly $1.5 billion, and it'd be up to correction officials to decide where does this money need to go. So there's additional flexibility, as Bill has noted, in that area. Interestingly enough, though, the Department of Juvenile Justice has things delineated by institution. There's also money in there for the state fair here in Springfield and the DuQuoin State Fair, and my guess is that that money is not going to be spent.
Well, Charlie, let me ask you something on that, that giving that authority to the governor. Is that the legislature abdicating its responsibility, or is that, you know, a prudent way to go in your mind of how to deal with this situation right now?
No, I think it's the legislature acting prudently in that in these uncertain times, you don't really know where you're going to have fires that need to be put out, fiscally speaking, and it gives the governor added flexibility. And traditionally, governors have had the opportunity to shift 2% of operational spending. So 98 cents of every dollar was locked in, but 2 cents, if this line item, if we needed more for salaries or if we needed more for commodities than we thought, we could shift 2 cents out of every dollar into that particular line. This says 8 cents. So it's not a real abdication on the legislature's part, and it gives the governor added flexibility, which I think is warranted under the uncertain conditions. And there's changes even in the existing budget. For example, there was authorization to spend $200 million for contact tracing, as part of our efforts to try and get a handle on what's happening with COVID.
Now, Charlie, how about this, though? Wouldn't this give the governor and controlling Democrats a little bit more power if, say, somebody, a Republican legislator with a prison in his or her district, if they were barking loudly about some snafu at the governor's office or something like that, not going along with the governor's plan, wouldn't this be something they could hang over their head and say, you want a little more money for your prison this year? Quiet down?
Yeah, but the transfer authority in this particular case wouldn't make any difference because, as I said earlier, there is no individual allocation. So if, for example, right, you're unhappy with Senator Menard, who I believe has Taylorville Correctional Center in his district, since there's no money actually spelled out for Taylorville, but rather it's within the whole budget. So I don't think that would be, my guess is if the governor wanted to squeeze people, where he'd do it is in those 5,000 individual projects. So I maybe won't get money for the playground, or I maybe won't get money to fix up that broken road, that kind of thing. That's where he could hold it up. Because, as is always the case, all of these capital projects, at the end of the article spelling them all out, there's a paragraph saying none of these monies can be released without the approval of the governor.
I did want to mention also this week that the governor made the announcement that bars and restaurants could open to outdoor seating if local officials agree. Sam, that it sounds like the mayor of Chicago threw some cold water on that, happening as quickly as the governor might have indicated, which would be by next weekend. But still, this was something that probably was some good news for bars and restaurants, many of them struggling. Some of them even have closed since this pandemic began and they were forced to limit and prohibit indoor dining.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw some data just in the last couple of weeks that said restaurant bookings were down 100% across the country. And then as some states have began to open up, restaurant bookings went from 100% to 98% down. It's even in some states where restaurants have reopened fully, the public really hasn't had much trust to come back. But that's a separate issue. The fact that a lot of restaurants have been able to be open to do curbside pickup, online ordering, that still, you know, is only half the business. You would be making a whole lot more if more people could come into the restaurant and sit down, because, you know, it is sort of a social experience as well. So we'll see if this props up folks. I'm still hearing from some restaurant owners and even from some Senate Republicans this morning that the amount of seating in a lot of these places is still limited. It's not 100%, but it seems to be a compromise that the governor's been willing to do.
And if it doesn't stop raining, those places that don't have an overhang of some sort, I guess they would be out of luck, too, even if that was allowed. Let me save a couple of minutes here at the end for one of the stranger moments I thought of this week, and really of recent legislative sessions. This involved a state lawmaker who made news recently by suing Governor Pritzker over his stay-at-home order. This is Representative Darren Bailey. He is from southeastern Illinois. Well, he came into the convention center in Springfield this week for session not wearing a mask. Rules were passed saying you have to wear one to be on the floor. He refused. He was escorted out, came back the next day wearing a mask. But, Bill, you were following this. Just your thoughts on what took place there.
Well, certainly that first day, a lot of the open Illinois protesters were around the convention center and then marching to the Capitol. So Bailey certainly had an audience of friendly supporters right outside the building. And as a couple of 100 of them were marching between the location of the House and then the location of the Senate. And so I think Bailey, it played to what he was trying to do on that first day. The second day, there were far fewer protesters outside, a dozen or so maybe. And I think the game was over, and he decided to get back down to business, so to speak.
And Bill or Sam, maybe we can clarify this. Lawmakers were supposed to have a COVID-19 test before coming to the Capitol. That was something I saw it on Facebook and other places. A lot of lawmakers were doing that. And that was supposed to be the case to make sure you were not infected. Bailey, apparently, a lot of his fellow members thought he had done this, and apparently he had not. Is that correct? Is that what we heard?
Yeah, that's right. The reporters had sort of cornered him outside and had asked him the question, and he said no, he did not get a COVID-19 test. The governor had harsh words for him on that, saying that he was purposely endangering lives by not following the public health protocols that were agreed to by a majority. And it's also worth noting, Sean, that a number of Republicans broke with Bailey during this whole mask kerfuffle, if you will, saying that, you know, if you're not going to do it for yourself, at least do it for those around you. It's not about whether or not we're wearing masks or not. We have more important business to get to.
And just about a minute here, Charlie, but I get your thoughts on this well, because I don't think I've never seen something like this before.
Well, I have. And what it is that the chambers are allowed to set rules for how you have to dress in there. The House has always been looser. For example, it does not require people to wear coats and ties. The Senate does. And that's a rule that no one could argue, well, it's for one's health and safety. Whether or not I go in the Senate with a coat and a tie isn't going to affect potentially anybody else's well-being. And yet, 40 years ago or so, Governor Jim Thompson appeared on the Senate floor without a coat, and the sergeant of arms escorted him out of the chamber, and he had to go back down to his office on the second floor, get a sports coat or suit coat, come back up to the Senate chamber on the third floor, and he was allowed admission. Now, in my mind, comparing Jim Thompson to Darren Bailey would be like comparing Michael Jordan as a basketball player to me. So I think Bailey was totally grandstanding, and in an area where potentially he could affect the well-being of some of his colleagues. And I would guess that the average age of an Illinois House member is probably greater than the average age of the Illinois public as a whole. And so you have people who are potentially more vulnerable to this virus. And so what difference does it make? You put a piece of cloth over your face, that's not that big a deal, for heaven's sakes.
Let's go down to our notes from the field. Sam, we'll start with you.
Well, while all this has been going on, the news that had been in the past couple of weeks was that there were a number of lawsuits that were facing Governor J.B. Pritzker in his capacity as the governor, in terms of whether or not he overextended his executive authority by extending state home orders. Attorney Tom DeVore, that Southern Illinois lawyer who has been making the news, is continuing to fight that fight. The initial case with Darren Bailey, who we were just discussing about, has been pushed up to federal court. DeVore said, no, it needs to go back to circuit court. So there's some push and pull with that. There is a hearing for that case that will be scheduled at some point. But there's another suit that's been filed. There's a hearing for that today. This time, a tanning salon is suing Governor J.B. Pritzker. So I think at some point, the higher courts are going to have to take up this question. Otherwise, DeVore is just going to keep filing suits.
Charlie?
Well, it's interesting because we've all seen how we're kind of with the stay-at-home order. Stay-at-home orders and the lockdown, and you would think that the economy kind of grinding to a halt would probably result in fewer traffic accidents, and yet the National Safety Council reported this week that more people died in traffic crashes in Illinois during the first quarter of the year, which would include March, when we were initiating the lockdown, than in the same period last year, an 11% increase. So apparently the supposition is that because there are fewer cars on the road, people feel emboldened to drive a heck of a lot faster.
All right, and Bill?
Well, we're seeing a lot of things go on party line votes so far. The budget and the election bill would be a couple of examples. But we're not really seeing rancor, even with the party divide. I thought perhaps early in that session, the whole Darren Bailey thing may lead to a lot of political fights in the House, and that the minority party Republicans would stall things. But that has not come to pass. Everybody, I think, has been very polite in a session where there's a lot of party line voting.
All right. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. We'll follow up on what the legislature winds up doing after we've recorded the show on next week's program. Our panel this week included Charlie Wheeler, Sam Dunklaw, and Bill Wheelhouse. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.